Welcome to the Marshall Pruitt Podcast presented by Cooper Tires. It is time for our week in sports cars with my co-host and co-pilot, Graham Goodwin. Mr. Goodwin, you're going to have a very abbreviated week at home. You are ready for some rapid travel coming up. I am as well. Let's talk about what we have coming up. Also, a little bit about what happened last weekend in the world of sports cars. Then we have a bunch of great questions to get to. So, Graham, you there in a creaky chair in the UK, me here at the MP compound in the San Francisco Bay Area. We did have one fun thing take place here in the U.S. when it comes to sports car racing last weekend, and it was the fine Silhouette Series, known as the SCCA Trans Am Series. Had our friend Paul Tracy, IndyCar star, IndyCar champion, bon vivant, make his return to motor racing after many years in, I guess, a self-induced retirement. And he is now questioning as to whether he should be getting back in and racing on a more permanent level to go with his broadcasting duties. I don't know if you got a chance to look at any of the footage from last weekend. Some of the in-car was a blast. The cars themselves are pretty amazing. You look at whether it was PT and his use of the chrome horn. You look at some of the great fighting that went on where we saw another former IndyCar driver, Rafael Rafa Matos, win, PT's teammate. And then our friend Chris Dyson, American Le Mans Series champion, who is back doing circuit racing again, closed the weekend with a victory. I know your passion for sports cars is one, Graham, where when you hear Matos, when you hear Dyson and Paul Tracy and Ernie Francis Jr., and you know, whether it's young, old, retired, coming back, a lot of great names with a growingly popular series. I'm guessing you wish you could have had a little time portal to pop over quickly and watch the Trans Am Beasts at Road Atlanta last weekend.
Well, you just said the magic words, at Road Atlanta. I'd watch anything at Road Atlanta. I'd just watch Road Atlanta with nothing racing. But yeah, you said about the Beasts there, Marshall. There was a great pick on social media after Chris Dyson took a win, I believe, at Road Atlanta, of a front-end view of that car. It just looks like a cartoon-like extension widthways of a Ford Mustang. Fabulous-looking thing. But Paul Tracy, just one of those iconic names, isn't it? It just brings to mind all sorts of street fighting in more than one way. You know, aggressive racing, something we've always loved Paul Tracy for. But yeah, the names, the cars, the venues, of course you'd want to come and see it. You know, it is Trans Am, one of those probably not very well understood by people this side of the pond, where that kind of sits in the great kind of cocktail of North American road racing. But as a national level championship, still sends hearts fluttering with a great big V8 beast, doesn't it?
Absolutely. So with the Trans Am weekend in the books, and I think, honestly, one of the higher profile weekends Trans Am has had, and it was a standalone, right? It wasn't as a package part of an IndyCar weekend or otherwise. We've said this a few times in recent weekly episodes, Graham. I think Trans Am's starting to get somewhere. It's going to take a while. It's got a big mountain to climb to get back to where it once was in terms of prominence, but I think if they can have more Paul Tracy's in there, and who knows, maybe some other guests. I'm guessing if a call was made to a certain Alan McNish, granted, they would have to get all kinds of seat boosters and steering wheel boosters and you name it, but you throw in the names of a bunch of drivers who we love who have recently retired for whatever reason, I'm guessing, realizing that most of them have never had a chance to race a giant Silhouette car, right? They've been in prototypes, they've been in GT, whatever it might be, production-based, but they've never been in this big tube frame, 800-horsepower, crazy-looking monster. Guessing there'd be a lot of people who'd want to show up and help continue to bring awareness to the series. So I'm heading off to play IndyCar this weekend, and that certainly isn't the topic of this podcast. You, on the other hand, Graham, are getting ready to flap your wings and head to France. For those who maybe aren't aware of what's coming up this weekend, this is really the one big come and look at it, come and get it ready. Don't know if you show everything, but try and get everyone ready for a season and a half, essentially, of FIA World Endurance Championship competition. Tell us about it.
Well, it's more than that in the coming weekend. In fact, we're going to be down there for the better part of 2 weeks, Marshall. We leave tomorrow. We've decided to drive down through France simply because we're cheap. But we can get all the guys actually into the DSC Fun Bus. And you're right, it is the WEC Prologue, a day of media activity followed by 2 days of track. Actually, it will be a 30-hour continuous test this time, the first time they've done it back at Paul Ricard, principally because it's a 30-hour test, and Monza, where we had the prologue last year, won't allow them to do that. So we're going to have 3 days with the WEC. We then have what's cunningly called a day off, which of course never is. Then we get 2 days with the ELMS runners, the 40-plus cars of the European Le Mans Series. We'll replace them again at Paul Ricard. A day with the Michelin Le Mans Cup, GT3 and LMP3 runners, another so-called day off, and then we get into the first ACO rules race of the 2018 season with the first round of the European Le Mans Series and the Michelin Le Mans Cup. But the main event, I think, for many, is indeed the first chance we're going to get to see the full field, or very, very near the full field, for the FI World Endurance Championship. That will come first with those 2 days of running, literally 2 days of running. And boy, oh boy, are there things that I think we're looking forward to there. It will be our first opportunity to see the BMW M8 GTE in its European colours with the Team MTEC team there. It will be our first chance to see in public the new Aston Martin V8 Vantage GTE. So the two new cars to it, first chance to actually see the Evo version of the Ferrari 488. All of the private teams running a myriad of Porsche 911 RSRs through both the LMS and the WEC. But most of all, I think it's fair to say, MP, it's going to give us the chance to see all of the new cars that are going to be doing battle in LMP1. The Totas will both be there, although three of their drivers won't be. We won't be seeing Fernando Alonso this weekend, nor Kazuki Nakajima or Kimi Kobayashi. They're all going to be busy doing other things in Formula One or in Super GT, Super Formula. But we will get to see and Davidson Alex Wurz back aboard the cars, which would be great. And we will also get to see at least one each of the new LMP1 non-hybrids, together with the returning Bicolis. And that, I think, is what's whetting people's appetites for track action to come. We've got certainly one car that won't be there. The second Rebellion R13 will not be ready. The first of them is due to shake down, I suspect, while I'm in the car on the way down at Paul Ricard. They could literally just chuck it over the fence onto Paul Ricard. That's how close Orica is. And I think it's a race against time for the second Ginetta Mechachrome for CFC TRSM, Mana in old money, to be ready. But we should be able to get to see, have an opportunity to see the kind of general form that we might be seeing in the early battles in the WEC. Will there be sandbagging? Will there be trickery? Will there be sneakery? Yeah. Who cares?
And that's what I wanted to move to next. So this is the WEC's version of IMSA's Roar Before the 24. We know that IMSA uses the Roar as another big data gathering point for them to then use on BOP formulation as we go into the start of the season. Obviously, you have a variety of preseason tests. I mean, this is a preseason test, but we have some that, you know, go back even further when it comes to data gathering on GTE cars, etc., etc. How is this different, as you have observed it, or maybe you expect it to be, Graham, in terms of the ACO and FIA digging in, gathering data? How intrusive might it be, knowing that, you know, again, by comparison, that we've seen IMSA actually asking some teams to try some various configurations that they think might be right going into Daytona? How does this play out in terms of governing, testing, and working with the teams to get the almighty BOP Formula right to start the season?
Well, the first thing that's very different, of course, from the Raw before is that we're actually having this test at a track where these cars will not be racing, because the race at Paul Redcar is not for the LMP1 cars, it's the LMP2 led, the LMS. So that's one major difference. But yes, I think we are going to be having the big brained guys in the technical department of the ACO and the WEC taking a good look at what they can find out. The key here, though, MP, and I think it's where there might be some issues with that process, is those LMP1 cars are very, very new indeed. How new? I think this will be the second time that the Rebellion R13 would have run. It will definitely be the second time that the Gibson-engined BR1 from Dragon Speed would have run. And if the second Ginetta makes it to the track, it will be the first time that that car has actually run. So gathering things and making decisions about the ultimate performance from packages like that on the basis of what, for most of them, I think will be a shakedown, I think would be pretty ambitious. I think we're looking probably more towards Spa and towards the Le Mans test day for some of the ultimate hard sums to be actually ground out here. But, you know, they all hold. Every single one of these cars has got a data gatherer that is property of the race organisers and the rule makers. So there are no hiding places for anything those cars are actually doing out there with testing. I would hope we're not going to see anything knee-jerk here from anything that that emerges. All sorts of, you know, rumour and speculation and stories that are doing the rounds about Toyota has asked for this because they've been a bit rattled by that, or, you know, the LMP1 privateers have asked for the other. The reality is, and I think it's the glorious thing about this season, is we literally don't know. We don't know whether or not the reports that have been coming out from early season testing that have got the best of the running of the non-hybrid cars within tenths of the Totas are correct, or we don't know whether or not we get to Spa and we get to Le Mans that Señor Alonso and co. are going to be seconds up the road. I don't believe they are. I think they've got an inbuilt advantage on efficiency. I'm not sure they've got quite as much of an edge as perhaps they'd like on ultimate pace.
And I think you raise the most salient point of what might come out of this weekend in terms of lap times, specifically for the LMP1 category, much less so for LMP2. And this is something we've trailed and covered a number of times in recent weeks, knowing how some of the LMP1 hybrids, non-hybrids, I should say, are relatively short on miles. Could be, you know, we could have a chassis that actually has a fair amount of data, but with the engine installation in particular, that's the new angle. Whatever it might be, you raise a great point, Graham, that frankly, like 2017 at the Roar before the 24, when IMSA had a whole fleet of brand new Daytona prototype internationals and even the WEC LMP2 cars that were really starting at zero in terms of not just data gathering, but also developing and finding speed. Really, it's upon the teams to learn how to get the most out of the package, use that to then go on and succeed. Well, if you go to the lifespan, look at that arc of how you do that. There are going to be a number of teams this weekend that are thankful they're going to have 30 hours to try and do that, because that will be the biggest bulk of time they've had, by and large, to learn and tune and test with their cars. And actually, you know, we can expect some failures, whatever those might be. This is something where we would not expect to see peak performances out of every team this weekend in light of the learning that they still have to do. So if you were to be in that position and you were sandbagging, I would say you were an idiot, because if you don't know everything you need to know about the car, and many of them don't, to then intentionally be trying to hold something back, that would boggle my mind. So I'm not saying there won't be any sandbagging. Probably, if that's taking place, we can assume it would be more on the GTE side. But by and large, if I am a prototype team with a car that needs mileage, my lack of pace should, in theory, be our lack of knowledge being demonstrated, not trickery and tomfoolery. So we will see, though, and that's one of the things you and the DailySportsCar.com team will be sniffing out. So tell us then, Graham, about what comes out of this weekend as we kind of wind down and head towards getting to listener questions. And I'm going to send you some WD-40 or something to spray on that seat.
Sorry about that.
What comes out of this weekend? What is that process like in terms of gathering data and then getting it ready to be used here? I mean, it's not too far away before teams head to Spa, but we know IMSA's process is one where they will gather that data. They will then hold individual calls with the manufacturers in the specific classes where BOP is used, which is all now, and not necessarily have a back and forth conversation on agreement or disagreement, but at least say, hey, this is where we're going, give you a little bit of lead time to prepare for it before these things get published publicly. Is the ACO and FIA approach to this similar, or how would that work as WEC teams look towards SPA?
Well, I think the first thing to say is we're unlikely to get any immediate conclusions from the weekend. I think it's going to be far more about setting the scene. We know, for instance, we are due to hear what's actually going to happen about the Sebring meeting in 2019. That should come on the day before we get track running on the 6th of this month. So that would be Friday. That's really the media day. I suspect we're going to get to hear a lot of driver announcements. Whether or not they are, you know, made formally, or whether or not that's, you know, in conversation with some of the teams telling us about the way that their teams are going to come together. I think one of the things that will be fairly unique to this season with the WEC, I expect a lot of driver changes through the season. And that's come principally about the way in which this is operating commercially, this very odd 18-month season. A lot of the teams are selling these packaged into packages of races. So whilst there will be people who will be fighting throughout the 18 months of competition from now until the Le Mans 24 Hours in 2019, there could be an awful lot of others where we see some driver changes between the teams once, maybe even twice, through the 2018-19 super season. As for what we find out technically, well, you know, it's become a bit of a kind of, I'm not going to say battleground, it's become a bit of a kind of competition in itself to find out what's going to happen with that data. This is this thing that you and I have spoken about previously, MP, and this is going to burn our first mention of, in this case, equivalency of technology rather than the dreaded BOP. That it is news because, of course, it does affect the way in which these cars race come the 6 hours at Spa and the 24 hours at Le Mans. But the reality at the moment is I think there's even less understanding out there as to what a particular restriction placed on an LMP1 car, for instance, might mean in terms of ultimate pace. That's simply because we don't know about the ultimate pace. Another one to look for, and this could be very interesting moving forward for competition on both sides of the pond, is the difference in pace between the LMP2 cars. Because for the first time in WEC competition, in the new era of LMP2, we do have a Dallara chassis with a Gibson engine, and we do have a Ligier chassis with a Gibson engine. We also have, I think we'll find confirmed, 3 of the 7 cars in the WEC LMP2 class will be on Michelin and 4 on Dunlop. What we should be looking for there is if there are massive differences in pace between those packages, because if there are, then that could be a big change. The door has been left open for balance of performance adjustments to be made in that class. Well, you know what, as well, over 30 hours, of course, that means that the guys will be running in full darkness. Maybe we get a chance. The weather down in the south of France can be quite cool. At times, we have actually had snow at the prologue test once before. I can remember standing in a garage the year that Marco Andretti, in fact, was racing for Rebellion at Le Mans and chatting to his grandfather. And we were looking out the back of the garage with the cars going back on track in darkness, and snow was tumbling. Wow. So we might get a bit of rain. I don't think we're going to see the kind of level of rain, though, we've seen across the UK over this Easter weekend, MP. And I've just finished watching, as we record this podcast on, what day is it today? It's Monday, isn't it? It's Monday evening.
Not April Fool's. April 2nd.
Indeed. We're watching the races Wilton Park, the British GT Championship, where second race, by the way, was cancelled. It started under the safety car, but was then abandoned because of standing water literally everywhere. But delighted to say, a bit of history in the British GT Championship on Monday morning with Johnny Adam, Le Mans winner, of course, for Aston Martin Racing, one of five Aston Martin Racing factory drivers, one of nine factory drivers in the British GT Championship this year, partnered with young lady Flick Haig, who's done duty around the world in all sorts of GT machinery. Flick put the car on pole on Saturday, and she led from the start in horrible conditions, pulled out a really good lead, and they won the race. Flick Haig, the first ever female driver to win overall in the British GT Championship, and in doing so, we won't mention the person that this remark is perhaps directed most towards, beating 67 male drivers in that. wait, one other female driver in that field. Marvellous stuff. Excellent for Optimum Motorsports. Great to have those kind of headlines as we go into what I hope is going to be an increasingly entertaining British GT season.
Speaking of entertaining, let's move into Q&A, my man, which is...
It could be my favorite.
Well, we hate talking to one another, so this is actually a good excuse to limit that in some way, shape, or form. So as we mentioned, knowing that we frankly just put up an episode a few days ago, and we did not get to all of the questions that came in last week, asked folks to just add on, pile on to what we had. And so we've had some new questions come in, and we also have some that we did not get to, Graham. So with all
Should I start with the first one?
Well, I would say go ahead and rock away. And as we've been doing the last week or two, I'm going to try and do one answer per question when
Absolutely.
Possible.
Well, I'm going to go with one that we didn't get to last week. And apologies to James Counter, because it was actually the first question posted. Why do some GT3 manufacturers seem to feel lots of cars in one series seem to ignore others? Notice this watching the VLN this weekend. Lots of Porsches, disappointing lack in the Brompan, arguably a more visible series. And what a race VLN was last weekend. Indeed, it was. The reality, though, is, for the most part, it's not down to the manufacturers. Yep. It's down to the customers. These are, for the most part, customer vehicles. And you're absolutely right. It was pointed out to me, we just mentioned the British GT series, no Audis or indeed Porsches in that series, or indeed Ferraris in that series this year, but still a 36-car grid. So people are making their own choices about this. And actually, in an era where it could very easily become pretty spec, the fact that you've got such depth in GT3 and increasingly in GT4, I think can only be a good thing. It does mean that in some series, you've actually got cars that are barely present anywhere else. In Britain this year, we've got five Aston Martins, each of them with a factory drive report. GT4, we've got a couple of unique machines. We've got the Toyota GT6, GT4, and we've got the brand new Jaguar F-Type GT4. Fabulous looking cars. I think that's a wonderful part of GT racing, and I hope it never, ever, fades into abeyance in the years to come, MP.
I'm going to move down to the question from John Nottage, and I really like this. This is also another one that we orphaned from last week. We're bad parents, Graham Goodwin.
Me both.
John says, I'm going to get hate on this, and sorry to use one of your three mentions of BOP. I think we're already up to two now, Graham, so
we're
teetering. But he's going to say it anyways. I'm okay with having BOP. I have great memories of creative sports car design from the 80s and 90s that today's rule book just won't allow. That said, wouldn't you both agree that the cost and technology have pressed too far to not have a BOP system for competitive non-spec racing? When done correctly, it results in excellent multi-make action. If no BOP, what would be a functional alternative? Well, John, let me go back to the one notion here, and I do end up mentioning this every episode or two. I don't agree that we are at such an advanced stage of cost and technology today that BOP is involved, or should be required, or should be involved. And that's because in every era, you are at whatever the pinnacle is of technology at that time, and there's a heck of a lot of money being spent during those eras as well. And so, not to go too far here, but when disc brakes were first introduced at Le Mans, for example, that was like outer space technology compared to the drum brakes that were in use. Was not cheap to develop. Wasn't something that could be easily purchased at the time. At whatever little stage, the technological steps in sports car racing, for whatever era we happen to be in, you're at the pinnacle in somewhere in the world. I realize that there are times where things have been dialed back globally and things get a little bit less creative. But for the most part, I don't see anything about today that's any different than the 80s, for example, when we had the Group C prototypes. We had the IMSA GTP prototypes. And what is different is back then you had either fuel-based equivalent, I don't know if I want to say equivalency formulas, but basically here's the amount of fuel you have for the race. These are all the liters you're going to have, all the gallons you're going to have. You're going to need to figure out how you can get to the finish as quickly as possible while knowing that this is all you have to burn. That was one way of doing it. Other ways of doing it was saying, okay, well, here's the weight and weight formula, engine displacement and cylinder formula, and you need to work within those parameters to come up with what you want to compete with. You can also modify the bodies, etc. And I'm sticking to prototypes here, but we also know that there was GT racing where the cars were effectively not too far from prototypes as well. The reality is, if you have things that are designed along a spec mindset or a really highly restrictive set of rules, it doesn't surprise me that there's BOP, right? True creative freedom was never really in mind. It was, let's come up with something that will keep things close and, in theory, keep the manufacturers happy, and then we can go from there. And it's, I think the one thing that has changed, John, era-wise, is it's been quite some time where just about every racing series said, hey, here's some loose parameters. Go come up with your ideas. Come back and play. If any one of you gets crazy in terms of beating everyone else, yeah, we'll probably add some weight. Or we'll probably give you some sort of air restrictor that you won't like. But, unless it's crazy, go out, come up with something, come back, and we're going to let you play among each other, with each other. And as we found, often, there were scenarios where a naturally aspirated V12 would have an advantage on certain tracks compared to the turbos, or vice versa. And across 10, 15 races a year, kind of sort of averaged out. Not saying completely, but just a different mindset. So the one thing, John, I would say to close this is the one change era-wise is the fact that we've had a single-make series for quite some time now, highly restrictive series for so long now, that there's at least one generation, if not two generations, of sports car fans, Graham, that have grown up without knowing what it's like to go to a track and realize that they really do need to go look at all the cars because they're probably a little bit different than they were at the previous round because teams added a this or subtracted a that or widened it, shortened it, lightened it, whatever it is. It's been a while since that spirit of creativity and freedom has been the norm in motor racing. So the fact that it hasn't makes me think that for some, if all you've ever known is BOP and you like the racing, you probably, I don't want to say don't understand, but don't get why some of us who grew up and lived in a pre-BOP era talk about how cool and different it was and how we'd kind of sort of like to see it back. So I'm not saying you're wrong in any way, John, just saying that I've seen other examples, as you mentioned, you have as well, and GTP did not necessarily die because the cost became so outrageous. We also had a global downturn in the economy that caused a couple of manufacturers to draw out. But at its peak, we had privateers and manufacturers fighting each other like heck, and it was phenomenal to watch. And it was not brutally painfully expensive. So that was all without BOP.
Well, you know what? Knitting beautifully with that comes Ed Juris, and Ed put in two or three questions in time for last week. I think we got to one of them. Are driver ratings worse than BOP? Why can't we go back to pro and am with a simple test? Everyone starts out as a pro unless you can prove you should be an am. Or if you're paid to drive, you're a pro. If you have to pay to drive, you're an am. Why do we make this so hard? I agree with some of that, is the honest answer. I do think we've got to the stage where the driver ranking system has become a bit of a millstone around racing's neck. And I do agree that it could be made more simple, but I think there's one premise you've made there, Ed, that simply couldn't happen. That is this business around if you pay to drive, you're a pro. If you have to pay to drive, you're an am. You would be astonished at the number of people you actually truly would believe are the it depends, I guess, if you ask the question, who are you paying? Are you paying the team? Are you paying? Are you sponsors that you're bringing with you paying, etc.? So on that front, that wouldn't work. I've always been a fan of there being two questions. Question one is, are you a professional racing driver? Question two is, do you aspire to be a professional racing driver? They're the two questions that actually count. And that brings in perhaps getting towards something like a three-tier system. But ultimately, it comes down again to that basic point, doesn't it? Which is, if you are there, as however talented amateur as you may be, do you have a God-given right to expect to win against professionals in the same race? And I guess the commercial decision that has to be made by those race organisers is, if you come to a decision that they don't have that God-given right, or that, in this case, regulatory-enforced right, what damage is that going to do in terms of the number of cars, teams and drivers that you bring to the package of racing and, let's say the word, entertainment that you dole out for a given race weekend? That's really where the genesis of Balance of Performance came, after the seesawing of entries through decades, I guess. So that's the feast-famine pattern with factory-backed efforts. That's what really led to the Balance of Performance formulas that we've seen in the recent past. Let's wait and see what the future holds. I do think we're getting to the stage now, MP, where increasing numbers of race organisers and rulemakers are beginning to kind of look at where we are and think, is this working as it should? We're seeing more and more now making those decisions that there will be a promoter's decision made that might overrule the pure rule of law. We've seen it this year with WEC, with the likes of Enric Hedman coming into LMP1, where his driver ranking would not normally allow that to happen. And I think we might see more of it in the future. I think we're getting towards an age where pragmatism comes into play just a little bit more.
I think the stopwatch has been the official form of driver ratings since the dawn of motor racing. And while I love the often silly efforts to pile on an additional layer of regulation and structure behind it with metal-based ratings for drivers, whether it is a pro-am driver, a non-pro, an aspiring whatever, who simply is failing to measure up, he or she is not within whatever percent is considered acceptable of the pro they're sharing the car with, or the best set in the class by a pro. There are some really easy things. And also, counter to that, those who are, maybe the proverbial fake silvers, those who are rated as non-pros, but we know either by, past experience or just within the paddock, we know, come on, man. I don't know how you pulled that one. Congratulations. You got that one over on them, but we all know that's a joke. You're a pro. The stopwatch answers all of these questions, Graham. And one of the things that I don't fully understand is why we rely on, quote, ratings more than just very basic numerical reports. Hi, the pole position at this track was 2 minutes flat by the best driver in your class. Your best lap in practice, night practice, morning warm-up, you name it, was 3 seconds off of that. Is that the limit? right? Whatever percentage that might be, but is a 3 second variance from fastest to slowest in whichever class we happen to be thinking of, is that the limit of what we consider acceptable? Because anything slower than that, and this person's probably going to be getting in the way. Or, you know, if you're that many seconds off of the fastest, we can assume that there's some other deficiencies that might be there, situational awareness and so on. And or are you rated, you know, as a non-pro and yet you're lapping within 1 second of the fastest? Well, clearly you're in the ballpark of pros, so we need to move you up. I realize that lap time data is one of the criteria used when handing out and doling out driver ratings, and you know whether a championship has been won. I mean, there's a lot of things that go into it, but I just think there's some really simple things that can be used to determine, you know, A, not only who falls where, but if you do, if there was no such thing as a driver rating system, we'd be fine, because again, lap times are going to tell. And if you have someone who's trying to game that Graham by going slower to get a slower rating, okay, then, you know, if we do decide to lock them into that, you're a pro-am driver, cool, then it's 3 years. So you're going to be locked into that. And if you go any faster, you know, if you get within X amount, then we're going to penalize you. We're going to, I mean, I'm just saying, if you if you want to joke around, you can joke around and catch people doing that. But at some point in time, you have to say, boy, those result sheets sure tell us a lot about who's what. And even if the car is horrible on that day, there's likely going to be a pro in it. There's likely some sort of comparison that can be done to tell us how the non-pro is doing, or vice versa. So, I don't know, man. There's so many things that just make me want to drink a lot of alcohol early in the day. And this is one of them. But that's all right. We're going to move to Doug Bonham. And, Doug, there's going to be no alcohol involved in this. Let's talk tires.
Oh, yes.
The nature of the business of racing has led many series to be one make tire series, while on the other end of the spectrum, the beautiful engineering wildland that is Japanese Super GT has one of the few active hot tire wars in both classes, including uniquely among the GT3 cars and GT300. Doug says, do you think there will be a chance for other series and classes to escalate into an active tire war anytime soon? Says, we have the tantalizing opportunity of Michelin joining Dunlop to a greater extent in the WEC LMP2. And then starting next year, Doug, we will have Michelin taking over all three classes of IMSA's WeatherTech Sports Car Championship. I can tell you this, at least from the North American perspective, Doug, what we have had since unification happened between Grand Am and the American Le Mans Series, and we spit out the IMSA WeatherTech Championship in 2014, there's been one class, GT Le Mans, where open tire competition has been allowed, and we haven't had a whole bunch of it. It has been, in recent years, purely a Michelin class. The other two classes, three classes, I should say, through 2017, were spec on Continental. And now with Continental going away, there's a part of me, Graham, that wishes we could have open competition. But from what I understand, Michelin will be the, quote, official supplier of IMSA's efforts here, or no?
No, I understand, and I have heard this from a rival tire supplier, that Michelin intend to leave GTLM open.
Good.
Now, whether or not somebody else comes, now I can tell you, and it's a tantalising snippet that we're only going to tell the listeners to this Week in Sports Cars podcast.
And don't tell anybody else after you hear this.
Don't tell anybody else. Just tell them you know something they don't. A bit like the Scott Atherton quote, but not quite. Is that we came tantalisingly close to a famous tyre brand coming back into sports car racing very, very recently. It's gone away for the moment. I think it will be back, but I think you can anticipate whether or not it is in North America, whether or not it is in the WEC, whether or not it's in both. There is something coming, and it's coming, I think, very fast indeed. And it's going to be, I think, it's going to give joy when you see what may actually emerge from this. But there is a tyre brand coming back into motorsport, or our particular sort of motorsport, that hasn't been around for some little time.
Man, I can think of so many bad puns to throw out there that will point to exactly who it is. But I'll be a good citizen here of our sport, Graham, and keep this one to ourselves.
Oh, indeed.
All right, mate. Well, what's next? What do we
Oh, I've
need?
got Justin Walsh. I've got Justin Walsh, who says, if Graham could choose any race car from any era to mule around the Roland audio recorder for a few stints to capture him in car audio, which car would he choose? But I can tell you, I have obtained an identical Roland recorder to MP, who put together those glorious, glorious podcasts with in-car sounds. We've got a few real treats in store, but the car, if it's one car, the one car that I would do it with, it's not a car that I'll be doing anytime soon in sports cars because it's a Formula One car. But it's not a Formula One car from the recent past. It is the BRM V16 Mark I. That, more than any other vehicle on the planet, for me, it's the most astonishing sounding thing. I don't know if you can remember. I can't immediately off the top of my head. Is it Into the Red, the Nick Mason book?
Yes, and is this V16 or H16?
Oh no, I think this was the V16.
Okay.
This is the original car. H16 came a little later, didn't it? That was the 60s car. This is the 50s car. The
Ooh.
terrifically, hopelessly uncompetitive car, massively complex dual-like V16. But the sound of that thing is like nothing else I've ever heard in my life. The CD, by the way, that came with the book.
I have it.
It's an astonishing piece of audio, an absolutely astonishing piece of audio. One of those things that when you hear it for the first time, after you've actually got your jaw back up from the desk, you put it on again and again and again and again until finally your wife snaps and that's the marriage gone. It is astounding, absolutely amazing. That's the car, any race car from any era. There are many, many more. That I absolutely would love to strap the Roland to. The Lotto Aston Martin LMP1 car, for instance, the McLaren F1. It's a common theme here, isn't it? But the other thing is, it's anything we haven't heard before. And what we found, I think, from your recordings, MP, is some of the subtleties of the soundtrack for many of those cars. It's a great thing. One of the kind of things I challenge my co-workers too from time to time, if we're in a free practice session at a race meeting. We've done it, for instance, in the Radio Le Mans booth at the Nürburgring 24 Hours in a practice session, is look away from the window, don't look at the cars, now tell me what's passing. And it is, I wouldn't say it's remarkably easy, but the reality is you can do it. And that's still a wonderful thing about this sort of motor racing that I'm afraid all too often, fans of other forms of the sport, that's something they have lost and we have not.
Yeah, because we're better than those other forms of the sport. Damn it. All right, we're going to go to Ryan Casillas. Oh, let me actually top that off. So I know the question was for Graham, but I think I trailed this last week or the week before. But the next in-car sports car audio I'm going to grab, provided nothing changes and the thumbs up I was given at Sebring isn't rescinded, is I will be doing my second in-car recording with the Porsche GT Team North America's 911 RSRs at Long Beach. And I love that. I love the idea of what it should sound like because knowing that we are on a street course, in and around buildings and such, with a lot of reverberations from the best sounding sports car in the world, we are also going to try. And relocate it. When I captured it last year at now the newly named WeatherTech Raceway Laguna Seca, it was in the cockpit, and we are going to try and find a location for it out by the tail, right by the exhaust outlets. So
Parcel shelf.
if all that happens, no, even further back. If all that happens, boy, I'll tell you, I'm going to be happy and I will not wait to get that posted. But let's move to Ryan Casillas' question. He says, you guys are missing the biggest news in sports cars in the past 2 weeks! Exclamation point. Jordan Taylor's alter ego, Rodney Sandstorm, has his own Instagram. So, Marshall and Graham, when are we going to see you two donning a pair of Pit Vipers, cut-off jorts, and 90s NASCAR jackets? Ryan, I see, for Jordan, it's a joke. I can tell you, no, in all seriousness, if I were to leave our home here in Northern California and go visit my Pruitt family relatives on the farm in Marianna, Arkansas, there would be original versions of Rodney Sandstorms, bearing my last name. There would be no humor, no irony. It wouldn't be a little funny ha ha. There's no sarcasm. We're just kind of talking, real authentic versions. So I can say this, while I enjoy some of what Jordan has done there with Rodney Sandstorm, some but also it's a little bit close to home, man. There were times, having visited the farm many times, this is the farm where my father grew up, Graham. I did witness this. And I'm not saying it's bad. I'm just saying it's polar different, opposite from my little manicured upbringing, where my cousins walked out of their house on the farm with, I think, just a little, I don't think it was a BB gun. I think it was either a BB gun or a little 22 rifle, so, very small caliber. Basically walked out of the house with the little rifle in hand, walked around to some of the trees in and around the houses, and shot dinner out of the trees. It might have been, and again, not joking, squirrels. Shot some squirrels out of the trees, and that was going to be dinner. Again, man, I for all I know, I probably ate some when I was there. I would have been, 7, 8, 9 years old. But all I'm saying here, Ryan, is, yeah, that one's actually not too much in the vein of sarcasm and funny ha-ha. There's a little bit of Pruitt family genes in that existence right there.
One quick question, Marshall, because I need to know, after they did that, how did the bear taste? Because on my view on it would be the bear must have been delicious. A lot of meat there for everyone.
No bears.
Fur kept sweet.
No bears, but I'm just telling you, if it was furry and could crawl or climb, it was probably gonna have, a bullet fired through it and get thrown on the old grill to be fricasseed or who knows what. But
Mate, with your face fur, you need to be pretty careful down on the homestead now. Just watch yourself.
maybe that's the reason why I haven't been for 20 years, but
Right, I'm going to move along to Brian Benz. What do you guys think about BMW? Their drivers taking DTM as a priority over WEC. Very simple, they're wrong. Also, what are they going to do with the clash of Fuji, particularly on the last round of the DTM, if they keep wanting them to do DTM, because Farfus and Eng can't race at PLM that weekend. Farfus also can't race in WEC. They miss a driver in both races. Who will they choose for replacements? And there's maybe that the reason that Colton Herta has already tested the BMW M8. I think there's a lot to play out here. I've seen the same report you have. I've spoken to some of the same people that those people have spoken to. And we know what the decision is today. That decision might be very different depending on where championship positions lie a little further down the line. I just think we're at a stage now where all of the major championship race organisers need to take a good hard look at themselves. We've got, I think, as many, if not more, significant clashes this year than I can remember. WEC in a year where we've got this 18-month super season, the frankly, a little excuse for having as many clashes as we've actually got. I don't place all of that at their door, but certainly some of it. Has it impacted on a number of people in terms of not just their championship aspirations, but also their earning potential? Yes, and I'm one of them. It's as simple as that. Well, yeah, but the reality here is this needs to be taken much, much more seriously and on a wider scale than perhaps they've taken before. We have got, again, I'm sure we'll, with other questions, get back to this. There is too much cynicism about the so-called battle between WEC and IMSA. I don't think that is the roadmap that's currently being written. But one of the best ways to show that is not to have this nonsense actually occurring moving forward. They are two very high-profile championships with a lot of factory interest, and that needs to be taken seriously. And DTM, if that's what the factories are going to choose to do, then I'm here to tell you, I believe they're completely wrong. It's the wrong thing to do. DTM, I think at the moment, is withering on the vine very rapidly. It doesn't give me any pleasure whatsoever to say that. But the fact that in last week's show, MP, we're talking about the potential for that to be a GTE-based series, you know, in pretty rapid order, or at least the potential for that to be one of the options are being looked at, you know, that's a series in trouble. It will happen if the factories determine that to be an advantage to their championship aspirations from doing so. They're the circumstances in which it will happen. Decisions that can be are made in January can be reversed in June or July or August, as we've already seen with the changes that were made to the WC calendar. I hope we don't get to that. I'd like to see, you know, good guys in good cars with great teams having an opportunity to fight for a world championship, because remember, that's exactly what it is in GTE. It's a world championship.
Yeah, and on the Colton Herta front, I mean, I would love to see the young lad getting the call up to do, you know, to fill in where needed and gain some experience there, Brian. But it would be a surprise to me if that ended up being the case, knowing that, you know, really, Colton was not brought in to be the future of BMW. Maybe that could be a place where he evolves in the future a little bit. But for the most part, this was a long-standing and ongoing relationship between his father, Brian Herta, Bobby Rahal, who used to drive for and won IndyCar races as a member of that team. This is looking at a way through the BMW Team RLL effort, obviously runs the factory BMW effort in IMSA GTLM category. This is looking for a way to get Colton some experience being a part of not just a manufacturer, but the driving development and academy type program that BMW has, knowing that while he is competing and, you know, we think his second year of Indy Lights this year will be his final and would then move on to IndyCar next year, it isn't really something that he's going to get in that system. He's going to learn a lot in these somewhat high-powered open-wheel cars, but there's no real, you know, teamwork-based effort with direct co-drivers and just a manufacturer that has a fully fleshed-out program to take a young talent in, whether it's the media training, physical training, etc. That's something that Brian saw BMW could offer, and he has helped to orchestrate. So just a little bit different. And I'm not saying BMW would not or should not have looked at Colton and said, hey, we want to sign this kid up to be a part of our universe. But we do know that Colton, who is, you know, still school age, is truly looking at IndyCar as his destination, not sports cars as his primary interest. All right, let's see. Nicholas Langdon, seeing the Endurance Masters test day on dailysportscar.com, I was reminded how only 6 or 7 years ago the majority of prototypes were open top. Do you think we'll ever see new open-top sports cars again, or does driver protection necessitate the closed top? It's an interesting one, Nicholas, because, you know, things do tend to go in cycles. We obviously had open-top everything for a long time, and then we started to close the top. And I mean, if we're talking prototypes specifically, we've been open, we've been closed, we've been open, we've been closed, we're now closed. I could see us going back to open, but I don't think we're talking about a few years from now. I think we're talking 5 to 10, maybe, and it would take some sort of societal shift for, hey, we want to see the drivers work. We don't like them being covered up and hidden, or safety, get rid of it. No roll hoops, too. We're getting rid of all that as well. You know, you never know where things are going to go, and that's one of those kind of dumb throwaway statements, but you know, I could not have predicted that the answer to IMSA's answer, and also, I guess, the world's answer to sports cars, sports prototypes, as things collapsed towards the, in 92 and 93, was to come back with these open top kind of, you know, almost junk formula, obviously excluding the Ferrari 333. And there were some very good fast cars that were made, but I'm just saying comparatively, no one, I don't think most people would have expected that as the response. Maybe a little bit slower version, cheap, you know, maybe if cheaper was something they wanted to, but to cut the tops off and have that be the response, I think it surprised everybody. So I just mentioned that, Nicholas, because I don't know where we're going to go 5 or 10 years from now, but that same kind of like, oh, I wasn't expecting that, could also happen here again.
Well, I mean, I'll add just this, MP, and I note that you've neatly sidestepped your genius bit of April foolery with the aided and abetted by your partner in crime, Mr. Andy Blackmore.
I have no Halo idea what you're talking about. Cannot confirm or deny.
Yeah, the Halo on an LMP car I thought was pretty much genius. Excellent, excellent stuff. But I'll say this, having been there and witnessed the horrific incident that involved Marc Genet in a Peugeot 908 at the Le Mans test day, where a tiny error led to that car hitting a concrete wall with the crown really of the monocoque, the top of the canopy of the car, and punching a hole through what I would guess would be a 3-4 inch concrete wall at least. And the car surviving to the point where Mark, I seem to recall, broke a toe, and that was about it. I don't want to go through back to an era where that could have been all too different. I love my sport, and I love the cars, and I love the racing. I like the people, and if the cost of actually making sure that we don't have to write another obituary is that on the odd occasion, we don't get to see these guys working as we used to be able to in the cockpit of the car. That's a price I'm perfectly happy to pay, I'm afraid. We saw it again with Loic Duval, a not dramatically different part of the circuit at Le Mans. It is an extremely dangerous sport. The cars are getting quicker and quicker and quicker again. And when things go wrong, they will go wrong quite often, very quickly, in a terrifying fashion. I'm not prepared to pay the price, that anybody pays the ultimate price for my entertainment. Simple as that.
Well, I agree. But again, it's hard to say where culture and thoughts will take us. You know, we're moving over to Formula One and even IndyCar. We have an era in F1 that... Well, the cars are quick. You cannot argue that.
Oh, yeah.
But visually, they, for the most part, don't seem to excite people the way that they once did. The engine sounds don't excite folks the way they once did. You can look at IndyCar this year, finally in 2018, the visuals are quite nice, but they aren't as fast as they once were in super speedway form, you know, the big track records we got used to. You know, some of these things are a bit of a surprise as to how or why we got to a place where those making decisions were influenced by whatever factors that got to them and steered things in certain directions. So, I probably don't have to keep repeating. I've had drivers, you know, as a mechanic and otherwise, I've had drivers die that I've run. I've had drivers that I've run horrifically injured. I've seen all the worst, nastiest sides of this from when I was turning wrenches or engineering or you name it, and so I don't have to keep repeating that stuff, but I've seen all that stuff. I don't ever want to go to another driver's funeral. Same time, technical regulations, open top, closed top, whatever. It's not something that we tend to have much of a voice in and where things end up going. And speaking of where things end up going, whose question are we going to next, Graham Goodwin?
We're going to go to, this is one for both of us, isn't that nice? Never heard of this. Shea Adam.
It's Shea.
That's how she spells it.
Yes.
That's how she spells it. Adam. Given the recent burst of snow, what track would you most like to go around the sled? Obvious. Come on. The Nordschleifer. It's a longer ride.
Yeah, I mean, I would almost wonder if Mazda Raceway Laguna Seca, which is now, as of yesterday, become WeatherTech Racing Way Laguna Seca. I'm almost wondering if that might be a fun one in light. If you started at the Corkscrew, I
Yeah.
think you could get all the way down to turn 11, almost turn 11. Then you'd have to run a little ways to get to the crest of the hill to then head down to. The Nordschleife would be fun, but there's a lot of ups and downs, so I'm just trying to think of something that has a significant down you can enjoy for a while.
Brands Hatch certainly does, but it's not. It wouldn't get that far because it goes back up to Druids. You might want to try Andy Lally on that front. Do a bit of street lugeing there. That'd be quite fun, wouldn't it?
Yeah, that we have you and I should not. We should have used a lifeline here and brought in good old Andy Lally, because that is someone who probably knows all the merits of the various tracks that we head to and what they might offer in that regard. All right, well, we are kind of sort of rounding to the end of this episode here. We have six, seven, eight questions left.
Okay.
I'm gonna move to Daniel Kincaid. He says,
Ooh.
yes, listening to Graham talk about the possibility of a unified Le Mans in the future with the ACO and IMSA got me wondering, what could have been in 2015 if Nissan would have been more on the pace and with four manufacturers in LMP1, would they have been able to lure another manufacturer back into LMP1? Having 15 or so cars with a chance of winning would have been fantastic. Or would it still have the save, or I'm not a little bit clear on this, but or would it still save the end results of the teams outspending themselves and pulling out still? So, do you think that the little bit of collapse that started with Nissan and what ended to continue moving there with Dieselgate and Audi pulling and then Porsche, do you think if things had gone differently in 2015, that might have been staved off somehow?
Well, let's put it this way. I mean, it's a source of eternal regret to me that that went the way it did. I thought, I love innovation. We've been talking about this for most of the show this evening, and, it just didn't work. They placed some trust in some suppliers and some concepts that just didn't produce. But the way the public responded to the GTR LM, I think, went to show that actually there's a lot of love in the room for that, even though it didn't perform. But looking at where we stand today, if that had been successful, and if the team behind that effort had managed to persuade the Nissan Renault board to actually continue the adventure, then the reality is we'd have Toyota versus Nissan today to be thinking about into 2018, 2019. And that wouldn't be a bad thing, now would it? I think the answer here is you can pay your money, however many hundred million euro it is, and take your choice. They chose to go with a formula that was designed to push technology. And it did. Forget the fact that we've lost Porsche. Forget the fact that we've lost Audi. Look at the numbers that have been achieved in the last 4 or 5 years. We talked last week, MP, about the astounding racing that produced. But let's not forget the technological achievements as well. Using 40, 50% less fuel, less carbon-based fuel for a 24-hour race. Look at the achievements in terms of the battery technology, producing double the number, the amount, or rather storing double the amount of energy for the same weight of battery, just about year on year, never mind over a 2 to 3 year period. They are astounding results in technology, and that comes at a cost. Ultimately, the manufacturers and the rule makers have got to decide whether or not that is sustainable. They have decided at the moment that it probably isn't. Sadly, that means you've then got to come up with something that edges a bit more towards the spec. And that, I think, is something we should all be very sorry about. By the way, when we talk about hundreds of millions of euros and dollars and whatever the pound's going to be worth in a year or two's time, God help us, let's not imagine for a moment that everybody is as horrified as we are in motorsports by the prospect of those numbers, because in the automotive industry, they just aren't. That there, ladies and gentlemen, is a proportion of an R&D budget. And with where the manufacturing business for motor cars is going in the future, then that, if it produces technologies that will give those manufacturers an edge in what's going to be a very different marketplace in the years and the decades to come, would have been very small beer to gain market advantage in what's going to be a very different marketplace.
You're like smart and stuff. You should do word talking for a living.
Is it me next?
It
It
is.
Is.
You next. Come on, man.
Here
I am complimenting you about how smart you are, and you drop the ball, you're fired.
I'm terrible. Right, from a sled to Alpine, with Alpine making cars, do you think there's a chance they'll get more serious than their prototype program? No, I don't. The Alpine LMP2 program was always about brand building for that arm of the Renault-Nissan empire. They've now got the Pretty Little A 110, the new car, coming to production. It's going to be a one-make racer. It's now going to be a GT4 racer. We've written this week on DSC about where the first two cars are going into French team for French GT4 and GT4 Euro Series. I think there was a moment where there was the potential for that to be possibly a slightly lower end semi-factory LMP1 effort. That might still be there. I think it depends on what happens in the marketplace with the Alpine brand. I hope it does. I think there are two or three people would like to push it in that direction. They generally, of course, tend to have a vested interest. Will they succeed in getting the increased enhanced budgets that are required for that? There's a possibility, but I don't think it's there in the immediate future. And that principally is because the very same bodies that are pushing it in that direction, that principally is Philippe Sino's Signitec outfit that's behind Signitec Alpine, are putting more of their resource into producing the GT racing versions of the little Alpine, and therefore will have less engineering capacity unless there's an expansion on the way to start thinking about moving up from LMP2 to perhaps LMP1. I think that would be where it went if it went anywhere at all. Will there be a GTE? Don't think so. It's just not that kind of car. Let's wait and see. But at the moment, they've had a look. They've had a sniff around it. They've tried to get the budgets together to do it. It didn't work. I think their moment may have gone.
Corey Showmaker is up next. He says, I've heard rumors of hybrid DPIs for the next cycle of regulations. What are your thoughts on a mixed hybrid, non-hybrid class for DPI, or would we have to split it into DPI and DPIH? Well, Corey, that more than rumors, that is a fact. It has been discussed as a possibility with the manufacturers. Interesting. What I have heard... and again, I know this has been the angle. It's been steered a little bit. If we might get to this place, would be a spec unit. And Graham, at least for me, I will never be able to reconcile the word spec and technology in the the spirit of technology together. It's when I hear these things, I think of a spec brake pedal or a spec steering wheel. You go, okay, cool. You're doing this to save costs, to simplify, etc. But it's not being done for any form of advancement. What I might like about this, Corey, if this does come to pass, is if we're looking for ways to make DPIs, and keep in mind that provided everything goes in the direction it is, it wouldn't just be DPI. It would be whatever this top-tier ACO/FIEWEC/IMSA prototype regulation is. If it is something that allows the cars to put an extra 100 horsepower, 150 horsepower to the ground, and does not require the engines to be crazy technology or expense, because we have seen that manufacturers by and large are very wary of spending a lot of money right now on prototypes. This might be a good solution if we're just looking for a way to make these next cars faster than just a standard DPI, which is a WEC P2 car, although it looks a little bit different. Speed-wise, it's essentially where we are at there. And would say, if we're talking about, hey, these are now hybrid cars and high-tech, well, again, we would know that wasn't the case because it's an off-the-shelf system. No one's truly developing them to make their road cars better. But if it is something that we can say, hey, boy, these things are faster, and instead of just having the quoted 600 to 650 horsepower that we think... can be put to the ground, but on deployment, we could get to darn near 800. I really like it if we're just talking about the show, putting on a better show, Corey. But anything other than that, I would have a hard time pushing that as a big tech initiative. As for how that would be split or not split, I still don't know what's coming, and I don't think we know what's going to come in terms of will we have this American DPI-ish type formula with the next regulations and a global one as well? Or will the global go away and they'll all be DPI-type cars? Not sure. I would hope that whatever we end up with, Graham, as we've discussed here many times before, they're made available. There's non-exclusivity, so that if customers want to buy them, they can. So provided we go down that route, Corey, in theory, we could just have one. We wouldn't have DPI, DPIH, DPILH, SMFT. Just be simplified. But as we know, sports car racing is not simple. So keep your ears peeled and everything else tuned, and who knows what's going to come, Corey. But it would be silly, I think, if this next formula didn't include some sort of hybridization.
I can hear the pain in your voice, MP, and I think this is where it's the big question. It's not whether it's this or whether it's that. It's how you balance the two. And I completely understand, more now than probably ever before, why it is that the ACO are wedded to the technology side of things. If you want the manufacturer money, if you want to capture the imagination of the people signing off those big bills, then you have to address technology. It's not a FOP. It's not a trend thing. It's a reality right now, and it's never been more important than right now. But equally, you've got to address also the budgets that are into racing. There's some massive, massive, massive decisions to be made. There is definitely some form of coming together here. Is it going to be enough? I think we'll find out pretty darn soon. Let's move on. Let's move on to Andrew Backer. If P1 DPI conversions happens, what would be better for the health of sports car racing? Lots of OEMs competing full season and only one or the other, VIMSA WEC, or fewer OEMs, but each with a strong full season commitment to both series? It's a great question. It's one actually I was discussing with colleagues just a week or so ago. What I want to see here is that the people involved don't get greedy, that they don't strike a strong arm organisations, because bear in mind that some of these are actually, you know, that they're backed by major global corporations. Some of these are programs that have managed to be funded by national, in the case of some of the IMSA series entries, national importers and manufacturer representatives, and are not operating on budgets that would necessarily allow that step up. What I want to see, if we're going to come together, if we manage to make this work for 2020, 2021, MP, I want to see that we're being realistic about sustaining both those products, WEC and IMSA, and that we don't start to get that bickering that you can sometimes see, which is, what do you mean going talking to Acura behind our backs and trying to get them to do a full WEC season, or vice versa for that matter? You know, I hope we don't get there. What I'd love to see is, let's say for the sake of arguing, 8 to 10 interested parties in that global prototype formula, with an interest in perhaps running one or two high-profile races in both, but actually having their main season either in WEC or in IMSA. That holds advantages for everybody if you can sustain it, because then you're talking about turning over a proportion of 10 rather than a proportion of 4.
Well, we have the penultimate question for the week coming up here, and I might need to lean on your powers of recollection a little bit, Graham, because my mind is failing already, and it's only Monday. All right, this comes in from Thomas Pendergrass. It's a great podcast. Love the interactive community style. Does I seem to remember reading somewhere that Toyota was offering a version of their Super GT engine for LMP1 customers. Is this still the case? If so, it seems kind of odd they would want to compete against themselves. Now, I do recall when they were offering the naturally aspirated V8, and I believe Rebellion used that for a little bit, Graham, but I'm struggling if the twin-turbo V6 that is currently being used by Toyota in their LMP1 hybrid is the Super GT engine is being offered for LMP1 use.
There's a lot of engines that have been offered for potential LMP1 use. Amongst them, a version of Audi's DTM V8 that has actually been out there and came pretty close to being used in LMP1 competition not that long ago with customer cars. I think there's a lot of engines that could, more or less anything could. You quite rightly say there, MP, that wouldn't be the first time that Toyota have done that, because they've done it with that normally aspirated V8 before. Remember that TMG in Cologne are, yes, part of the Toyota empire, but they're a commercial entity in their own right. They're a cost and profit centre in their own right. They are empowered by Toyota to find commercial opportunities for the technology that they have access to. Hence, for instance, they build little V3 class Toyota GT86s that do battle in a one make series in the Nürburgring for the VLN. So, yes, I think it's out there. No one's chosen it in exactly the same way that, to some people's eternal regret, no one's chosen the Judd option so far this year. But these are early days. What I think, let's just put this out there for listeners. What could be quite exciting is if at the end of this week at Paul Ricard we start to see some very interesting numbers coming in terms of pace of those LMP1 privateer cars. Who's to say that we might not see other people stepping up to the plate? Maybe not for later in 2018, maybe for early in 2019, when there might be the odd berth available if anybody falls by the wayside in the WEC. And certainly there's nothing to stop a team from putting in a one-off application, particularly if they're stepping up for LMP2 in 2019, to try to get a berth on the entry for the Le Mans 24 Hours in 2019. I think there's potential for something new to emerge in the months and the couple of years to come on that front. And I hope it does, because I've said it before, I'll continue to repeat it. For me, one of the very best things about our part of the sport is the variety.
Well,
last question.
That's a good one. Take us home.
Well, it's another one from James Counter, who I think we had a question from earlier in the show, and I think this one's particularly pertinent. What was the best April Fools you saw? I like the DSC ones. Thank you very much. And thanks again to Paul Marquardt, to Matt Fernandez, and to Dan Hounsell for their assistance with that one. I laughed out loud at the WC Halo. And again, kudos to you, MP, and to Andy Blackmore. What was my favourite? My favourite wasn't this year. My favourite was last year. My favourite was, it was another DSC one. In particular, a doff of the DSC cap to Dan Hounsell for his spectacular rendering of the now infamous Volvo DPI. the reason, as MP, I know...
Tell us the full story. Come on.
the reason... was it a week? 2 weeks afterwards?
About, I think it was 2 weeks. Yeah.
2 weeks afterwards, and I got a text message. In fact, I got a flurry of text messages along the lines of, you're not going to believe this, but... So we had this wonderful rendering of the Volvo DPI. It's still on the DSC site, so by all means take a look and wonder at the fabulousness of that rendering. And it was the Long Beach IMSA race. Yeah. And during that race, our good friend Calvin Fish did report that as fact, which... it still gives me a chuckle to this day. God bless you, Calvin. We had a bit of an exchange about it afterwards. I believe he corrected himself on air, having got the heads up. But the best of these things are when actually you can truly take people who know their stuff with you on that journey. I've seen others in the media offer the most stunning opinion, which is they would never, ever run an April Fool's without specifically stating it was an April Fool's joke. Come on, guys, get over yourselves. You know, this is, whether you like it or not, not just an industry. It is a part of the world of entertainment. That is what sport is. And we love to entertain. It's been part of the tradition at DSC since we started. I'm not going to stop it anytime soon. And I'm delighted that the likes of you and Andy, MP, can take come together with us and provide that stuff of very high quality. I had fun yesterday with this. I know a lot of our readers did too. I got some lovely notes from some of the manufacturers we took the Mickey out of this year, Toyota, Porsche amongst them. Some of the guys from the SRO quite enjoyed us having a dig at them. It was, it's a fun day. And once one day out of 365, we can take a day off from taking ourselves a little too seriously.
Yeah, that's a great point. There were a couple of angry, a couple, not that many, but there were a couple. I hate it when a respected news outlet, falls, drops to its knees and participates in April foolery and whatnot, as if they're, there's some hallowed institution that should consider such things beneath themselves. I mean, look, if that's the opinion that someone holds, and that's their opinion, that's fine. I'll just say this. You can go to a variety of media outlets, and they are dry as a bone. They have no personality. At no point in time do they make any effort to make you smile, laugh, feel anything. It's just news, 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 and go out of the way to do anything that is the least bit human. So I look at April Fool's as the one day a year out of those 365, that number you happened to mention, I think, not by mistake. The one day of the year where you can have a little bit fun, a bit of fun, and in theory, everyone knows you're having fun. And in this instance, it was a Sunday. No one breaks news about motor racing on a Sunday. There's some practical stuff. I had one guy tweet me. He was like, "So the stories about the halo and about this, that, and the other, are those things April Fools or not?" And I'm like, "No, all real, all true." And it's like, brother, come on.
on.
It's April Fool's Day. If you don't. But at the same time, I think, maybe racing's in a worrying worrisome state, where my favorite here was Daily Sports Car's announcement that Spa 24 is going to adopt Fan Boost for the pro drivers class, the perfectly named Fan Favorite Selection, FFS, for flirt's sake. I think you guys hit it out of the park there. That was a lot of fun. And I have to give a lot of credit to Andy Blackmore. I gave him the very basic instructions of, could you please come up with a halo on a prototype or a GT, your choice, make it look kind of like a Giorgio Piola technical drawing, and left it, and that was it. No chassis, I mean, just truly wide open. And Andy, being a phenomenal artist and a very creative mind, came up with that awesome halo drawing.
Beautiful, beautiful.
Then again, this is him helping me. Came back and, should we do the annotations in French? Could he had originally done them in English. Our friend Matt Fernandez helped with that very quickly, and swapped that out to French. And based on the more than 8,000 shares of that story on racer.com, and a lot of folks that either got it or wrote really heated, angry responses and then came back and either deleted them or followed up and said, "Oh, I only read the headline," or, "Look at the picture and it pissed me off, and I read the whole story, and damn you, Pruitt or Racer or whatever." Look, there's some mischief involved here. There's absolutely,
Yes.
it is, there are some outlets, as you mentioned, where, they pour it on so thick. Where you go, okay, it's almost not even funny or interesting, because you've gone so far out of the way to make sure nobody could be the least bit confused. And then even in one case I saw, they did all of that and added at the bottom, "Oh, and this is a
Oh,
April Fool's thing." And you
no, no,
go,
no, 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 please.
this is fun slash mischief. And just as, oh, how's this? We'll close on this little point. I read one comment from somebody, and I thought it was awesome to read this, because it spoke exactly, Graham, to how I view things. And they basically said, "We give you," meaning me and writers, "we give authors grief all day, every day throughout the year about whatever. And fair play, you got, this is your one day a year where you get to get us." And that to me was the perfect mindset, right? Like, hey, it's a comment section. You can just tear me apart. It happens every day. It's normal. But it was just kind of cool to see someone real like, oh, okay, yeah, you got me. But all right. This is how the exchange is supposed to work. But granted, we get 364 days where we could do it to you, and you only get one. So, anyways, I like that. I thought that was really, really good. So, with all that said, you got stuff to do, brother. You got to pack. You got to pick stuff up, run
Yeah,
around,
we've got
etc.
stuff going on.
And
This time next week, MP, we might know a bit more about what we're to expect in 2017. 2017?
wow,
2018.
I would
Oh,
hope
yeah.
so. We'd be really bad at our jobs if we're just learning about
We
last
would.
year.
But I hope we do know. I hope we don't know all of it. I think we're going to see some dramas. I think we're going to be very, very busy boys over the next couple of weeks writing up all the news there is to print. And this time, it will be fact.
Woohoo! Graham Goodwin, Marshall Pruitt, this is the Week in Sports Cars presented by Cooper Tires. We'll speak to you next week.